2005. Would the committee assistant please note that Senator Whitsitt is, and Senator Walker are excused at least until their time that they arrive here, and that as is Senator, or as is Representative Jensen. This morning we have a part of a process that we've been going through about the last two and a half weeks, finishing up on K through 12 and the Department of Education and the State School Fund. One of the things we were doing in the final 2 days of that period, and this is the final day, was to look at some representative school districts actually to give a clearer picture of what the impact on the ground is of our budget situation, not only in this biennium, but over the last 3 years. In that effort, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association has assisted us greatly in arranging for a number of school districts to come here, four yesterday and four today. Due to the nature of the time constraints that we have, we followed a pattern of having four each day, 30 minutes per school district, about 15 minutes for presentation, 10 minutes for question, and 5 minutes basically to make sure we stay on schedule. So what we will do is the same as we did yesterday. We will go through each presentation. We will go through a presentation first, wait till the end of the presentation, then do questions, then go on to the next presentation. That's solely to keep people on time, and because we have had many people travel considerable distances to be here. The first school district to be here is the Seaside School District. And Mr. Doherty, you're the superintendent.
I am.
Please identify yourself for the record and start through your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Doug Doherty. I am the superintendent of Seaside School District. Chairman Devlin, committee members, thank you for inviting me to join you today. This is my 22nd year in Seaside, my 7th year as superintendent. I apologize, my board chair, we had a board meeting last night. He felt ill and was unable to make it, and I apologize. It's important to know that every school district is unique, and Seaside is a school district of contradictions. We have some of the highest property values in the state and some of the highest poverty rates. For example, Cannon Beach, an area that has million-dollar homes, has a 58% poverty rate. We have the highest transient student population in the state, but we also have some of the highest assessment scores in both reading and mathematics. Our general fund balance is the same this year as it was 10 years ago, but we receive no state school funding. Referring to the demographic sheet, you'll notice that we are five schools. Seaside School District is Cannon Beach Elementary, Seaside Heights Elementary, Gerhardt Elementary, Broadway Middle School, and Seaside High School. Our enrollment total has changed less than 1% over the past 4 years. Our English language learners, our special education students, and our students living in poverty, though, have dramatically been increasing. We've worked hard not to impact the academic classrooms, and, for example, in the 1990s, one of the first reductions we made were to support services. We also reduced administration from 12 down to 9. And because we have used attrition to reduce staff, our salaries have virtually stayed unchanged, even though we have had salary increases that have kept our staff members even with the cost of living. And as you can see, our associated payroll costs, including medical insurance and PERS, have been significantly increasing. Our senior class members were kindergartners when ballot measure 5 was enacted, and we've been forced to reduce their program offerings ever since. Over the past 4 years, our changing student population has caused us to change our staffing needs. The needs of the few are impacting the needs of the many. For example, we have reduced one elementary music teacher and added a special education teacher. We have reduced a physical education teacher to hire an ELL teacher this year, and we need to consider hiring one or two more. We have transferred educational assistants that usually have helped in reading and mathematics to work in our special education classrooms. and we will need to continue to reduce electives to refocus our ELL, special education, and poverty student needs. But there are two reasons we are where we are: flexibility of funds and generous community support. Flexibility of funds, for example, I attached a OSBA notice. Our focus has been on school improvement, school achievement. As you can see, our students increased two full grade levels at 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th in both reading and mathematics achievement. But in 1999, the legislature provided a school improvement grant to bring 90% of 3rd and 5th grade students to their benchmarks. As you can see, we had already done that, and we were the only school district in the state of Oregon that was allowed to bank that school improvement grant. To us, this meant $600,000 of staff that we did not have to reduce. With generosity, as soon as the legislature allowed us to ask for a local option, we received one. We went out and we've passed two consecutive local option levies. We are in the second year of our second three-year levy. Local property taxes are continuing to increase. Although we have reduced elementary music, we've had two of our retired music teachers step forward and provide music education services for free for 2 years. We've had to reduce middle school and high school athletics by $100,000. Our booster club stepped up and has raised over $80,000 each year for the past 2 years. You asked me to describe how our district and programs have changed. Our community has really stepped up, and our community volunteers are in our classrooms and virtually every activity. We have more partnerships with local businesses and agencies, our Parks and Rec Department, Clatsop Community College, Providence Seaside Hospital. But since we have such a high transient population, we've developed all types of different transitional programs for families that move into our area. We have programs at the middle school and high school and elementary schools, which welcome students, help them to feel comfortable, and help their families adjust to our area. We're serving more homeless families. We have parents and families living out of cars, in shelters, several families in one apartment. We have residential students. But the one thing that we have not done over the past 4 years is we have not had to cut any school days, and we have not had to go and use the accrual. Several concerns I have. The academic targets, as you know, continue to move. With House Bill 3565, we immediately jumped on academic the outcomes, and we changed that when House Bill 2991 went into effect. We've dealt with the report cards, No Child Left Behind, the adequate yearly progress, and the annual measurable achievement objectives for language acquisition. Some of the pieces that Governor Kulongowski's proposed $5 billion budget will impact: it won't necessarily impact our state school funding, since we do not receive any at this point, but we will be in a position where we'll need to continue to retool. I know that you're interested in how schools have scored on the state report card. Gerhardt Elementary School was deemed exceptional. Cannon Beach Elementary was strong. Last year they were exceptional. Seaside Heights Elementary School is strong. They are probably going to be exceptional this next year. Broadway Middle School and Seaside High School are currently at the satisfactory level. All of our schools met AYP with the exception of Seaside High School in the area, one area of special education. There are many school districts that need the state school funding at the $5.3 to $5.4 billion level. We had the opportunity as the 20 school districts within Northwest Regional ESD to go around and talk about some of the areas and that schools will need to reduce. And I can tell you that the $5.3, $5.4 billion level was the area that they were hoping for to maintain current service levels. The bottom line for us over the past 4 years is our students are much needier. The cost of medical benefit packages and payroll costs are continuing to increase. And we would be at a very different place without the generosity of our community. Without the local option levy, we would be forced to reduce almost $800,000 in personnel. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are you Mr. Doherty?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry I was late. I just am compelled to make the statement because
please.
I appreciate what you said. I appreciate what we heard yesterday. And what I find is that our school districts have to hold out a tin cup in order to fund the things they need in their classrooms. You indicated your booster club raises $80,000 a year to help you, and local businesses have helped, and you've had to pass two local option levies. You're holding out a tin cup.
Yes.
I'm alarmed and I'm ashamed and I'm embarrassed. And I appreciate what your community is trying to do, and so many other communities are trying to do the same thing, and some are not as fortunate to be able to pass their local option levies.
Exactly.
So I just had to get out that out this morning. I'm sorry.
Thank you,
sir.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winston.
Thank you for coming over. We've been asking some of the other, yesterday we asked the other superintendents and board members that came, what's your contract based on with the teachers? How many days of school, instructional days, and how many days do you negotiate, does your teacher's contract call for? And I would like also, how many schools do not take state funding?
It's a relatively small number, I assume my comment. There's a great variety in terms of how much revenue comes from local funding. I think many schools with fairly good property tax values are probably in the 50% range, 50-60% range. And there are a few in terms of local money. And there are a few, like Seaside. Neocony, which is north of you, has always been a little bit similar to that. Sisters is very high. It's basically school districts with extremely high property values compared to number of students.
Mr. Chair, could you clarify for me then, how does that, so if his property tax keeps going up, does he get to keep that? His excess doesn't go into the school formula.
That's correct.
Okay.
But still in his situation, he's not so much above that he's just fairly above that, so that...
But it could happen where the property value could...
Yeah, theoretically, yes, yeah.
But
we don't really have anybody, I don't think, receiving significantly higher. Did I get a nod of the head back there? Sue, do you?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid I don't know off the top of my head. I know there are at least a couple that get more in local property taxes or local revenues than they would under the formula. And then Dr. Doherty, I think he indicated that there are four that he's aware of where they receive no state school fund. But we can check with Legislative Revenue Office.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, one of the examples we got handed out to Sue, because of timber money, that they didn't get any state formulas. Is that correct? One of the folders we got handed to us, they received so much timber money that they didn't get any state funds. Is that true?
There may be at least one school district that's... I don't know if Neocony comes from timber or if it comes from property. I think it might come from timber, actually.
Neocony, Nestucca, and Jewels primarily come from timber.
Yeah.
Ours primarily comes from property values.
The number of days.
Number of days, thank you. 190 with the full contract. And we have a full, I believe, 100, we have a full calendar. So
we've been told about 176 instructional days.
That's about right, yes.
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you so much for your presentation, and I'm really struck by your knowledge of your local community, and particularly what you have shared with us about how poverty is experienced in your community, and the fact that you have children who whose families are living in cars. Many challenges you're facing.
The piece with I also coach track just to spend more time with students, and the interesting piece with you know, we have several families who in fact are living out of cars. One of those students is on my track team, and the difficult piece is of course they're kids, and so they have those needs to you know that to feel like everyone else, and you're exactly right, the piece of poverty is something that we're all struggling with, but our community is doing a tremendous job in trying to make everyone feel welcome, part of the group.
I appreciate that. If I may follow up, could you help us get a picture of what happens to your students once they graduate from high school? First of all, what percentage graduate, looking at the last, just look at the last class, what percent went on to community college, what percent went on to a university, an Oregon university?
We have a large portion of our student population that goes on to two-year and four-year college activities. We have probably around 60%, 70% who pursue some type of college activity after graduating. We work very hard. We that's another area that our area does. We have hundreds of thousands of dollars of scholarships, and it is the goal of our high school and our community to provide support for those who cannot go on to pay for school to help them get there. And we work very hard to get everyone into a community college or a university who has a desire to do so.
You suggest by your comments that you're able to provide scholarships for all who need or want them? Is that accurate?
A good portion.
Very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that you didn't discuss in here is your class size. What's your average class sizes?
Thank you. Our average class sizes are around 24 to 25 students.
For
pretty much all. We're a little smaller in the primary. We have focused on trying to get primary class sizes down a little bit more than that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
You talked about Bell Measure 5 and living in poverty, and when I think of Seaside, I think of tourism and fishing and timber, and you've been there 22 years.
Yes.
What, and you're just a personal anecdotal view, what has been the significant thing that has really occurred in that area that has changed the most?
We are a service industry. We basically are a community that focuses on helping people feel welcome and comfortable as they come and spend their vacations. And the one thing that, it's the transient population that we have, where parents will come in for 6 or 7 months and then leave to find other work. And I think that that's changed more over the last 20 years that I've been there. That's probably the most dramatic change, is just how transient our actual population is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Doherty, yesterday we had testimony in my Senate Education Committee from a principal of an elementary school in Coos Bay, and 20% of her student population in her elementary school is homeless. Would you estimate that your homeless population is around that level? Does it vary by school?
It's how you define homeless. We do have families periodically that go into shelters. We have people who do have two, sometimes three families living in an apartment technically that's a definition of homeless, but we have a, I wouldn't say it's up to 20%.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What is your dropout rate?
Our dropout rate is right at the state average, right around 4 to 5%, I believe, is what it is. It's right at the state average, whatever the state average is. Sorry,
and that would be 4 to 5% per year.
Yes.
Right, for ninth graders going on. So
yes,
you end up with about the state average of, what, about 70% graduating that start in ninth grade?
That's probably about right.
Senator, did you have anything more?
No. Thank you.
One question that I had, although you're very unique in the sense that all of your revenue comes locally, you're also unique in another respect, and that is that your revenue hasn't gone up and down every year, so you've had some degree of stability. How would you compare the impact that that's had on your school district compared to school districts around your area that have had the up and down cycles?
That has been wonderful. The stability, just knowing generally how much we might have from year to year, has been tremendous. Probably for morale-wise, more than anything else. Yes, when there were the five special sessions, we were reduced $1 million through that in our own school district out of our $12 million budget. So we did need to deal with that.
Yeah.
But we are more stable than most school districts, and that helps rather than trying to guess and reduce to certain levels. We've been able to keep things much smoother.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
On this first page, your expenditure, you show 12.446, but your revenues are only showing 10.344. Is that federal funds, or how does that? What
partially federal funds. Partially, it is cash carryover that allows us to do that from year to year as well.
Any additional? Well, thank you very much for coming, and we very much appreciated your testimony.
Thank you very much for asking.
Let's go to a slightly different situation. The Hillsborough School District.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please proceed and give your names for the record.
My name is Monica Cordry. I'm board chair in the Hillsborough School District.
My name is Jeremy Lyon, and I'm superintendent of the Hillsborough School District.
Please go ahead.
Thank you for having us here this morning. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to your committee. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, we'll just first start out with a few facts of what our district looks like. We're a little more than 19,000 students. We're the fourth largest district in the state of Oregon. We have a high growth rate. We're in the middle of the Silicon Forest in Washington County. We generally have between 100 and 600 students per year over the last 10 years increase in our students. We represent 3.4% of all of K-12 students in Oregon. Fairly diverse district. We have 64% white, 26% Hispanic, some other minorities in there. Our free and reduced lunch is almost 40% of our student body. As you can see on the handout, we have over almost 900 classified employees. Those are bus drivers, secretaries, those kinds of people. 824 licensed staff, 67.7 building and district administrators. We have 23 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, 4 high schools, and 2 alternative programs.
I'm going to go over the current financial status of the district for this budget year, 04-05. We have a general fund budget of $130 million. Out of that, the breakdown is $72 million in salaries, $33 million in benefits. Purchase services, which is major maintenance, utilities, payments, charter school, alternative education programs, 12.6. $4.5 million in supplies, capital purchases of $330,000, other $1.3 million, debt service payment $568,000, and contingency unappropriated $5 million for a total of $130 million. One of the key, I think, characteristics of the Hillsborough School District is we're one of the metro area districts that does not benefit from a local option levy. We had a local option levy on our November ballot, and it was defeated by the voters roughly 60-40. So we do not gain from any local revenues other than a strategic investment program revenue source that we have with Intel as being the major employer in our community. The local option levy was estimated to contribute between $6.5 million and $8 million a year for the 4 years of the levy, similar in scope to what other metro area school districts are receiving in local option funds. If we were to roll up what you see in the Hillsborough School District today to next year with the cost estimates that we have, and you use the governor's 5.0 funding level, then what you see is that our projected revenue would be $129 million, and that's with an ending fund balance in excess of $10 million. Our total projected expenditures would be $136 million. So we could balance the budget by simply drawing down that ending fund balance, but obviously that is not a sustainable model. We would exhaust those funds at the end of year one of operations if we were to simply roll it forward. The second part of the presentation is to talk about the changes that have occurred in the Hillsborough School District between 2001 and 2002, and Monica is going to address those changes.
Beginning in 2001-02, our base class size was about 25-1. In other words, when we staff our buildings and tell them how many teachers that building can have, if the building had 500 students, they'd get 20 teachers. So that's what we're talking about when we say the 25-1 ratio. In 2002-2003, we unfortunately made Doonesbury by cutting 17 days from our school, sending our kids home early that much, that many days in advance. And we increased the class size that year to 26-1. The next year, in 03-04, we eliminated 222 staff positions. Those were administrative things like high school assistant principals, our administrative curriculum department that helps us provide excellent instruction to our students. We cut that department. We cut over 100 teachers. We cut all elementary librarians. Our schools don't have any elementary librarians anymore. We reduced counselors. We reduced elementary music, elementary PE. Those were all reductions. In our classified staff, we took major hits in custodians, maintenance, teaching assistants. Then in 2004-05, we also, in 03-04, we also, the effect of those 222 staff positions increased our class size to 30-1, and that is just an average. So in 03-04, we're at 30-1. In 04-05, we were able to restore class size back down to 28-1, and we were able to restore a tiny bit of elementary music and PE specialists back to the buildings. So kind of to summarize, from 2001 to the present, we've opened two schools a major high school and an elementary school. But we've suspended or reduced textbook purchases, technology in our classrooms, computers, those kinds of things. We've suspended roof replacements. And you know, you can only not put roofs in for a small amount of time. You can't do that forever. We reduced custodial services, maintenance, groundskeeping. We've reduced co-curricular and athletics. It's been pretty grim when I signed. I've been on a board member for 6 years, and I started this because I have a passion for public education, and I never thought that I would be presiding over making our school district worse when I started than it is now. I mean, it's been a gradual decline, and I had hoped to make things better instead of worse.
We are in the process of trying to look at the governor's budget and decide how we are going to address a potential $7 million budget cut. The first thing that we are looking at is to use a program that has been used by, I think the count is now 75 school districts in Oregon, to bond the PERS rate unfunded liability. And for us, that could potentially save us as much as $2.8 million a year over the initial PERS rate that we estimated of 19%. So that's something we're very keen at looking at doing as that whole piece unfolds this spring when they announce the PERS rates. We are anticipating that we'll be able to buy down the PERS rate, so to speak, by bonding the unfunded liability. And if we do that, we hope that we can reduce the $7 million beginning deficit down to about 4.2. We actually will see some elimination of unemployment costs. When we cut the 17 days in 2002-03, there were significant unemployment costs that we had to pay the employees that we basically laid off. Those costs are going to go away for our next budget, and that's about $500,000. So that's more than $500,000. That's $1.25 million in elimination of unemployment costs and the other internal savings that are associated with that. And we calculate that's going to reduce the deficit down to about $2.95 million. We're going to do some other things with we run our own food service business, and we are going to bill food services for some of our operating costs, which you can do legally. We're estimating that we can get about $500,000 in savings from that. We're looking at, unfortunately, increasing class size by one. We made it down from 30 down to 28-1, and each time you reduce it by one, it's between $800,000 and $1 million. And so as part of our initial strategy, we're saying we probably need to go back to 29-1 as a class size and achieve, in this case, about $800,000 in savings. So with those kinds of cuts, it brings it down to about 1.4 that we're looking at. And the rest of that will come from negotiations. We're negotiating with classified, although that's very speculative as to what those savings could or would be. And we also look at our ending fund balance in excess of $10 million to use whatever we need of that to balance the budget. So our picture is not dire in the sense that there are really terrible things that are going to happen in our district from the state that it's in today to the state that it will be when we open our doors next year. We are not looking at cutting days. We are not looking at draconian cuts in staff of any kind. But the problem is, as Monica outlined, we've been reducing over the last 3 and 4 years. And the analogy that I, or the image that I try to paint is one of we're at the floor. and we're at a very minimal level of services that we provide to students, and we're doing a good job. Our campus people are doing just an amazing job with a very limited set of resources. And so we're now at a level of sensitivity where any further cuts really harm that core floor level program that we have. And I think if you ask what are the biggest issues in the Hillsborough School District, class size pops right to the forefront. We're not where we need to be with class size. It is adversely affecting the quality of the education that we can deliver to students. And for us, that's a real priority. When I talked about how we'll get to a balanced budget, the very last thing we'll consider is that increase in class size, because we know that that's a point where we really need to try to make some headway in our district. The last part is simply to look at what we would need to continue our current program. Even a level of funding at 5.2 would make an enormous difference to Hillsborough. Every $100 million over the biennium for the Hillsborough School District is $3.4 million. So, I mean, it's significant money. And a move of $100 million in state funding results in $1.7 million for Hillsborough in next year's budget. So even a move to 5.2 would put us in a position where we could hold our own. 5.4, we could start delving into the area that we can start restoring some things that perhaps you and I would consider as essentials in terms of operating a school district. We had, as part of our budget process, identification of a list of buybacks and things that we would like to see restored if possible. These include buying textbooks, buying computers that are at the end of any reasonable replacement cycle, restoring funding to extracurricular activities. Our tin cup has been out for 2 or 3 years, and our local newspaper, in fact, criticizes us saying that we are losing our coaches because we're asking them not only to coach these programs but to do significant fundraising in order to operate their programs. So we'd like to help with that, but that's a buyback. We desperately need to improve our maintenance and custodial support. We've added significant square footage in the district at the same time that we've been cutting custodial and maintenance staff. Our administrative support at our four high schools is lacking, and we're seeing the effects of that, and that's a problem. We would like to restore librarians, and we would like to restore physical education. I know that's on the agenda this session. We have a very minimal level of PE that we're offering, and we'd like to restore that, as well as some music specialists. All those are buybacks at this point. So when you talk about additional funding, in Hillsborough's case, a move from 5.2 to 5.4, we could start looking at that list. 5.2, we can just keep doing what we're doing. And that's the kind of perspective that we have. 2 days ago, I met with a group of Glencoe High School students to talk about their experiences as students in the Hillsborough School District. And they wrote me a letter, and I will not read the entire letter. I just want to read two passages from, these are current students at Glencoe High School. This is from Anna Garcia. "The most important issue to me is that our classes are getting too full. There is not enough time for teachers to really get to know each one of their students and provide ample individual attention. Another thing that I feel strongly about is the gang-related problems we have in our school. I feel there should be more opportunities for Latinos to get involved with the rest of the student body." That's another effect of a growing school district, is we are making every effort we can to close the achievement gap and to provide services to a very diverse student body. And it takes people to do that. It takes people who can develop relationships and build relationships with the different groups, the new students that we have. This is a statement from, this is the last statement I'll read, from Malia Wagner. As a deeply involved member of choir at Glencoe High School, the continuing budget crisis has been very disturbing. For instance, in 2002, my fellow choir students and I faced the devastating prospect of not having our choir director, by whom I have been directed since the seventh grade, or choir the next school year. Choir is one of the reasons I thrive as a healthy, happy person in my school environment. With the continuing instability of funding, the music program at my school remains in jeopardy. This impacts me greatly. I plan on going into music in college. Without the continuing program within my high school, I will be unable to achieve my goals with the same proficiency. I know that there are others in the same situation as myself, and if this program is taken away, that future Glencoe students will not have a chance to experience the joys of music firsthand. And whenever you meet with students, you come away with a very deep respect for how talented, how bright, how optimistic they are. And we have a responsibility to them that that we take very seriously.
Questions? Mm-hmm. Senator Gordley.
Thank you. And thank you very much, Superintendent Lyon. Several questions. What is the disaggregated dropout rate for your school district?
I don't think I could answer that with any degree of accuracy. Our overall dropout rate is a bit below the state average of about 4% or less per year. I do not know how that is disaggregated. I know our Hispanic dropout rate is much higher than the Anglo-Hispanic rate. I don't know what the percentage is for the Asian American population. I can get those numbers for you.
Thank you. Following up, can you? What is the counseling ratio, student to counselor ratio within your district?
When we cut counselors, we fell out of the accreditation criteria for the counselor to student ratio, which my understanding is it's 400 students for each counselor. We fell out of that. And that is one of the reasons that was one of the restorations that we did this school year. We added counseling positions back at the secondary level so that we would meet those minimal accreditation guidelines. And we're now up over the 400-to-1 student ratio for counselors to students.
And can you relate that that counseling ratio to what the quality education model would define as being appropriate?
Again, I don't have the numbers. I will venture to say the QEM appropriates a much higher level of counselors than we are providing in our schools.
If this next question goes to your experience with the No Child Left Behind initiatives, under No Child Left Behind, schools are to make sure that students who need help, extra help, get that help in order to meet achievement goals. What does extra help look like in your district? Who provides that help? Does everyone who needs help get it when they need it?
That's a great question. When we have leveled this thing down to the floor, what you find in our school district is that we direct our title funds, which are really the resources that we have to address our high-need students. We have 8 elementary schools that are designated as Title I schools, and that is where we put the emphasis of our money for remedial help. One of the criticisms, and we identify those Title I schools by the percentage of low SES students as measured by free and reduced lunch. And so one of the common criticisms that I get is when I'll go into a higher SES school that's a non-Title I school, they don't have any of those extra resources, the reading specialists, the teachers that can pull students out and work with them in small groups on remediation and reading programs. By and large, our efforts are directed at the Title I schools. We run some full-day kindergarten programs through federal funding and that kind of thing. But at our non-Title I schools, really what it comes down to is the classroom teacher and the library assistant, perhaps, the principal, whatever we can assemble to address those needs. And that has been a criticism in our district, is that we're top-heavy on the resources going to those identified title schools, which is very important, but it does leave some people behind, some children behind at the non-Title I schools with a lesser set of resources.
One final question, if I may. You have some challenges in your district around dramatic shifts in demographics, and looking at the increased number of Hispanic students that you're serving and Asian students, black students, other students. Could you talk more about the challenges that you see in dealing with this increased diversity? What does cultural competency look like within your district? Just speak to us.
Sure.
About what you're experiencing.
We're very, very proud of the Hillsborough School District in terms of the efforts to address the diversity issues in Oregon. In the strategic plan that was crafted in 2000 and ends this year, there was an entire strategy around cultural diversity. We have been able to, through some grants, open an Office of Hispanic Outreach, and we are making many, many efforts in a variety of ways to make sure that our schools are welcoming places for all students. We do all of the things that we can to, for instance, we're holding 7 community forums regarding the budget over the next 6 weeks. The next community forum that we have will be conducted in Spanish. And we want to have processes in place in our district that invite and welcome diversity. And we work very diligently at that. One of our goals in this next round of strategic planning will be to make efforts to have a workforce, teachers and administrators, that reflect the population makeup within our community. We've got enormous challenges there. Enormous challenges. We have a very forward-thinking city. The city of Hillsborough does a great job with that issue of diversity, and we're partners with them, and we're looking for ways to help students feel accepted in all of our schools. And Monica, would you like to add to that?
Well, I guess the only thing I'd like to say is we have put a lot of effort through our strategic plan on our dropout rate. And while I don't remember the figures exactly off the top of my head, I know that our Hispanic dropout rate, as well as our other dropout rate, is falling. It's getting better. And that's been something that we are really worried about with the class sizes that we have, especially even in the elementary schools, is that those students may not continue. We may not continue to have that good news in our dropout rate because our staffs are so overwhelmed with the numbers of children that they have that they may not be getting some of the attention that they need.
I really appreciate the thoughtfulness behind your responses. Thank you very much.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your work. In this building, we're talking about savings, consolidation of ESDs. As one of the larger districts, if ESDs provide you service, can you better provide those services, and are there any savings?
The ESD consolidation discussion is an interesting one. I am not convinced that Senator Ringo's plan of requiring large districts, Hillsborough being one of them, would result in improvements in terms of our operation. Yes, we could provide those services, but the true cost of that is largely unknown. I think there is great merit in studying the efficiency issue of ESDs and looking at the consolidation and the way that they do business. We're very fortunate. We've got a very good ESD that we work with, Northwest Regional ESD, perhaps is the model of consolidation because they serve four counties. They serve 20 school districts, 17 fairly small rural school districts, and three very large school districts. And we understand we have a joint responsibility to not only take care of our own students, but also to provide the resources, the important resources in the areas of special needs children for equity across the board. And we work fairly well together. It's not to say that there are not some improvements that can be made, in my estimation, but we have to be very, very careful how we do that, and are they truly improvements, or are they just rearranging the matter so that the responsibility falls on someone else at the same cost, if not more cost?
Senator Nelson.
Another follow-up on a different subject. On this page, you indicate 2004-2005, $130 million approximately, and your projected expenditure for 2005-06 is $136 million, so there's about $6 million difference. Could you talk about the cost drivers? Is that is this figure adding programs, or are these just the cost drivers of health care?
These are largely uncontrolled and controlled increases in cost. That number reflects just a pure roll-up of services, so a snapshot of what exists today rolled up to next year. No cuts, no additions, nothing different, just rolling the thing up. And so the drivers are obviously the PERS rate is the big one, probably, for us. We've got the health insurance costs. We have our negotiated contract increases, which we can plug those numbers right in.
What other?
Those are the big ones. And then the normal COLA, cost of living increases.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnant, and then I'll have the final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to get in a lot of things, but because of time limits, because I'm interested in your reserve fund and also your Intel grant, but I don't think we have time, and maybe I can talk to you off after the meeting or something on that. We have asked all the superintendents, how's your contract with teachers, how many school days in class, and how many do you pay the teachers for? And along with that, how much, if you reduce school days by one, what do you save being the fourth largest school? Because we're told that if we reduce one statewide, it saves $30 million.
For us, we calculated at $400,000 is the value of one day. So when we cut 17 days, that was basically $6.8 million. And that's a rough number. And there's some unknowns in there, but that's a rough calculation that we use, $400,000. So I don't know how that compares to that state number. We have, by contract, 191 paid days for our teachers, and I believe our number of teaching days is 176. I think that's the right number. I will check on that.
Thank you, Superintendent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker, and then Senator Gordley. And then we will end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Lyon, I appreciate your testimony today, but I had to shudder a little bit when you talked about holding up Northwest Regional ESD as a model. It actually is one of the ones that has spent some money inappropriately, I believe. And maybe you might want to look at their budget and see how much of your money they're swallowing. And I think you might want to be involved in a little bit more in that discussion about how we try to get more money to K through 12 and out of the ESD pocket.
I appreciate that. I am new to the Hillsborough District, and so is the Northwest Regional ESD Superintendent Jim Mabbitt. And from the time that we have both come in, he is making those efforts to correct perhaps some problems that existed in the past. And I think he's sincere in that. So I guess I frame mine on what I have seen thus far. And he is, there's work to be done there. I agree.
And you're correct, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mabbitt came in and spoke to our committee. And I do believe he's sincere. And he inherited that mess. But it is a mess. And it is a palace that is just unbelievable. And I spent my Friday in the Douglas County ESD, and it's a former Safeway building built in the 1940s.
Been there.
So there's a lot of work to be done to make sure that money gets redistributed.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. I'd like to go back to the question about counselors for a moment.
Yes.
In today's school environment, what does a counselor do?
Well, they obviously deal with a lot of schedule changes. They schedule students. They manage the academic plans for students through their 4 years. They spend quite a bit of time on professional technical programs, college entrance processes, that kind of thing. I think they do a bit of counseling in there of students, meeting with students and talking about problems. Does anything...
What Dr. Lyon was referring to would be the role of a high school counselor.
Yes.
At our elementary schools, we call them child development specialists, but that's what they are, as a counselor. And they do many more working with individual students based on their needs, children of divorce or homeless kids or those types of what I kind of traditionally think of as counseling services more than schedule changes. At the elementary level, it's very, very much dealing with children that have some real difficulties emotionally and those kinds of things.
This is just Senator Gordley making an observation. You know, for several sessions now, for several sessions now, we've been hearing about the counselor-to-student ratio and how that's increasing. And I think, you know, this is like reality check. Do we really think that one person can serve the needs of 200 students, 300 students, or even 70 students, depending on a school district, whatever that ratio is? Do we really think that can happen in a way that best serves the needs of students? The answer to that is obvious to me, and I'm just struck that's where we are.
Right.
When we say that we're trying to move students through the pre-K through 12 experience and then hopefully into a community college one of our universities, there's guidance and preparation that goes along with that at every step of the way.
Right.
And we just have to admit that guidance isn't happening for... too many of our students.
We expect that guidance and that relationship to be built by others, and this is the confounding and annoying thing about public education to many, is that by design we are a fairly inefficient operation because we're dealing with human capital.
Mm-hmm.
And to be successful in developing the human potential, it's top heavy in relationships, and that is counter to an economically efficient model, and that's the bottom line. We're a people business, and it takes people to address the kinds of issues that we have, and that's at the heart of the funding issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. final question. In your numbers that you're presenting in terms of the impact of the governor's budget, and obviously you talked about some of the choices you had in terms of depleting your reserves entirely, obviously you're talking about, in terms of this current projection, you're talking about the next school year, and although it may not seem to school districts, we try to fund on a two-year basis rather than a one-year basis. Lately, we haven't been doing that very well, but I would assume that your situation at 5.0 would be just as dire in your second year.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Worse.
Oh, much worse, because yeah. You're rolling everything up again, and that's absolutely right. Our focus is that two-year perspective. The cuts that we hopefully will not have to make, but potentially will make this year, will be intended to create a sustainable budget through the entire biennium.
Yeah.
Correct.
One of the things that we've noticed, committee, is for those school districts that are going out for local options under the law, due to the efforts of both of our parties, both Democrats and Republicans, we have registered so many new voters in the state that the chances of anybody actually passing a local option before the next general primary election is minimal, if not non-existent. So any school district's going to have to wait at least until that time to even go out and look for a local option. So thank you very much for your testimony. It's very much appreciated. Oh, yes, we did have one more question. A very able analyst here says, we've asked every school district a question we didn't ask you.
Okay.
Now, I do not expect that you're going to be able to cite every one of your elementary schools by name and by performance, but in terms of the school report card and annual yearly progress, can you give us a basic, just sort of quick overview
yes.
of where you're at?
The overall performance on our school ratings, all of our schools, every single one, is either satisfactory, which is the majority of them, strong, which is the second leader, and then we have two that are exceptional. McKinney Elementary School got an exceptional rating by the state, and Indian Hills Elementary School also received an exceptional rating. That was the overall state rating. When you look at AYP, the district did not meet AYP, and the areas of student achievement that we fall short in are the student group Hispanic, special education, limited English proficient, economically disadvantaged, did all not meet. In terms of student participation, we did not meet with the Hispanic population, and we did not meet with special ed and with limited English proficiency. That's the federal AYP. So we have much to celebrate and much work to do.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Just to follow up on that, what's your opinion, and how do we fix this dual accountability issue that we have here?
You know, on the one hand, I see some merit in trying to create a hybrid unified report card, but on the other hand, perhaps there's value in keeping the state report card, which I think is a valid measurement of how our schools are doing, as a contrast to some of the stringent mandates that No Child Left Behind places on school districts. Hopefully we'll see some movement to improve it at the federal level. And if our state report card needs to be tweaked, well, let's do that too. But that is a complex issue.
Senator Gordley, and then we have to go on to the next school
thank
district.
Thank you. And I appreciate it. And I want to thank Ms. McGlashan for catching that question. I would like to know, and this can come in the form of a written correspondence to the committee, what is the district's plan, strategic plan, for increasing achievement for those students who fall below in the categories that you named?
Okay.
As it relates to AYP.
I will get you that plan.
What's the plan? Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. The next question is... Would the Ben Lapine representatives please come forward? Thank you very much for coming here today. Would you please identify yourselves for the record, and we will proceed with your testimony.
Senator Devlin, I'm Dr. Douglas Nelson, superintendent of the Ben Lapine School District.
And I'm Carolyn Platt. I'm past chair of the Ben Lapine School Board and still a member.
And it should also be Dr. Nelson or Dr. Platt as well. So we've divided this up. Dr. Platt will begin with the overview of our district. It's been very helpful listening to the questions you've asked, so we may answer your questions before you have a chance to answer them, and then I'll do some of the numbers. I'd like to say that in honor of Representative Wisnett, we have brought the sunshine from for which Central Oregon is known and brought it to the valley.
And the cold.
Yes, that's
well, you can have one or the other.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'll begin, and I want to thank Chair Devlin and Senators and Representatives for giving us the opportunity to come and speak to you today. The Ben Lapine School District was established in 1883. It's one of the older districts in the state. In the 1960s, 61 to be precise, it expanded to include two other very distinct districts, Sun River, represented Wisnett's area, and Lapine. Our school district covers 1,600 square miles. We have a north-to-south difference of 40 miles, much of it rural. Many of our students come from attend school from properties that whose roads are not plowed in the winter, which is significant for us. So that does affect at times our attendance. Our school district is growing very fast. We increased by over 300 students each year. We've grown at the rate of 3% per year in the last decade. Projections take us out to the year 2020 to be a school district that will exceed 20,000 students. Currently, we have 14,500 students in our enrolled in our district, and we're the seventh largest in the state. East of the Cascades, we're the fastest growing and the largest. The district has 14 elementary schools, 5 middle schools, 5 high schools, and 8 alternative learning options. We have added, in the since the year 2000-2001, we have added 1 new high school, 1 middle school, and 3 elementary schools. We anticipate needing to add, on average, one elementary school every 2 years, based on a 300 student increase. That would be 600 students new to the district every year. In terms of our students, it's not as diverse as Hillsborough, but we are increasing in diversity, and we're excited about that increase in diversity. To us, diversity is excellence. 36% of our students are enrolled in free and reduced lunch programs. Several of our schools have over 50% free and reduced lunch. 283 students in our district that we've counted are homeless. We have a significant portion of homeless students. Many of them are living out of their cars in the woods. We have obtained a federal grant for a summer program called Lunch and Learn, in which a number of students, particularly the homeless, attend and get a free lunch at federal cost and books, and they spend 2 hours a day learning and transportation if they need it in some 3 sites in our area. It's been a significant program in helping these students. Our fastest growing population of students is our non-native English speaking students. That population since 2001-2 has grown over 275%. 558 students currently do not speak English as their native language in our school. Special education is another area that has increased significantly. Currently, over 14% of our students are on special education IEPs. That number is 2,049 at the moment. 6 of our schools, Amity Creek, Jewel, Buckingham, Lapine Elementary, High Lakes, and Highland, have been named exceptional schools on the Oregon Report Card. And you just questioned the AYP progress, and it's a very interesting dynamic, I think, that's occurring, the difference between AYP and Oregon State Report Card. We have 1 middle school that recently, this past year, failed AYP. Lapine Middle School, and it failed because of attendance. We have, with school money, done quite a bit in trying to encourage these students to attend. We've bought alarm clocks for students. We have students calling students' homes. We have staff going to teachers' homes. Many of these are the rural areas that I spoke about at this particular school. They missed the attendance to qualify for AYP by under 2%, I believe. Another enigma, and I find this very interesting. High Lakes, one of our newest elementary schools, rated exceptional in the state report card, but did not meet AYP. And the reason it did not meet AYP this year is because two families of special needs students, severe special needs students, asked that their students not be tested, a personal right, I believe. And because we were too short, those two students, we failed AYP for that school. But an exceptional rating on everything else. Just something to think about.
I might add, of those schools that received exceptional rating, two are high poverty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for the good news, 70% of our students have met the Oregon benchmark targets. Our seniors have higher SAT scores than the state and national average. And our dropout rate is less than 4%. I don't have a disaggregated rate, but we may not keep it because our tradition, over the last few years, our population has been the diversity may not allow us to, it's been so small that we may not have been able to disaggregate our dropout rates. But with our ELL population growing, I think that's something we definitely need to track. But our overall dropout rate is less than 4%.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Yeah. Chairman, would you invite Representative Burley, could he come up and set up at the front during the presentation?
Okay. Yes, Representative Burley, if you'd like to come up and take one of the vacant chairs.
We share the school district.
We do.
Actually, Representative Burley has the majority.
please proceed. And welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Nelson will talk in more detail about class size. Class size, we've been holding a number of forums around our school district over the last month to talk about budget issues, present information about how schools are budgeted, receive their funds, where monies have been spent in the past, and elicit ideas and concerns from our community. Far and above all other issues comes class size. We have seen increases in class size of 2 to 4 students, depending on the level, and we can give you specific numbers as needed. But I think after sitting in on many of these community forums and hearing from our teachers, I think the class size issue is very important, but there is something missing to the average person looking at that increase in class size, and that is the changing dynamic in our classroom. We had a report at our last school board meeting from 4 elementary school teachers, and the class size began in a third grade class. This is typical of our school district. Began at a third grade class at 22. With the increase in population, this one class is now up to 26, and they expect to be at least by 29 at the end of the school year. Within that 26 currently, 5 are English language learners in the classroom, 3 of whom just moved here and have absolutely no English. 7 to 9 of those students are on special needs IEPs. And you can just imagine, out of a class of 26, the diversity of learning needs that one teacher must accommodate at a third grade level. Crucial time for students to be learning. And we have substantially cut back on aides for the classes as well. So not only do learning needs need to be met at the earlier grades, but the attending to some of the personal needs. A kindergartner cannot go to the bathroom by themselves. And we have 1 hour of kindergarten aid for a teacher a day. That's what we've had to do. So the teacher has to leave or pair with 2 or 3 students. We have modulars where kids are outside and have to go into a class, into a building, to be able to use the facilities. Just, I think we need to also pay attention to the dynamics that are going on in the classroom as well. Employees. The district has almost 1,178 full-time equivalent employees. 663 of those are teachers and other certified staff, teachers, counselors, and school nurses. And in a moment, I'd like to respond to Senator Gordley's questions about counselors beforehand, if I may. But let me go through the rest of the facts. 466 of the FTE employees are support staff. This includes secretaries, educational assistants, custodians, bus drivers, technology. We've cut substantially in those areas as well, and Dr. Nelson will go into more details in that. 49 of our district employees are administrators and supervisors, and that includes building principals and assistant principals. I would like to point out that that is less than 2%. Our central administration makes up less than 2% of our budget. The statewide typical average using the DOE figures is 6%. We have cut tremendously in that area. And the perception still of our public is that we're bloated in this area. I can tell you we're not, but it's an issue. Our general fund budget is $85 million, and our total current all funds budget is over $146 million. Am I doing? Yes, $146 million, which includes $20.65 million for a bond construction fund. That we're coming to our last year of the bond construction fund and adding, enabling us to add a little more capacity. But we will be capped at the end of this building. Going back, if I may, to the question about counselors, which is near and dear to my heart. My profession is as an independent counselor for students going to college, and I started the Central Oregon College Fair, which I secured the funds from private contributors to bring as many Eastern and Central Oregon high schools to the Central Oregon College Fair. 2,000 to 3,000 students attend a year in the attempt to help people understand that college is possible. And we hold workshops in Spanish. We hold workshops in English for parents. The counselors now, we've had to cut a counselor at every high school. We're down to three at each of our main comprehensive high schools for 12 to 1,400 students. So their load is about 400 students. And your question was, I believe, what do counselors do? How are they spending their time? And like our colleagues at Hillsboro, most of our high school counselors are spending time scheduling. That was true. And secondly, they're putting out fires, personal crisis intervention when they can, and it's usually the most traumatic personal crisis that they can attend to. There is a significant lack of time to, because of the increased loads, to do the academic and the post-high school counseling that is really needed and the direction to these students to get them on the right track. And I really feel that's an area that we need to increase. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Nelson. Thank you.
Senator Devlin and members of the committee, we've taken your questions that were submitted to us, and we've gone through them in a pretty straightforward fashion. I'll review them as they are on the backside of the handout. We wanted to continue to point out that we continue to grow. We've continued to grow since 2001 to 2000. Currently, about 8.5%. While the staff we have to service those students has declined by 57 overall, and that 17% of the our administrative staff has been reduced, and 13% of our support and staff, which includes, as we say here, educational assistants, custodians, maintenance workers, and so forth. During that time, we've raised our student-teacher ratio. Class size have increased from 32 to 35 at the high school. Middle schools remain flat, and I want to come back to that. Grades 4 and 5 have gone up by 1.5, and kindergarten through third grade has gone up 1. I think Carolyn's pointed out at the elementary level, particularly the issues with the diversity of the students with which our teachers are working. So I won't dwell on that any further. The reason the middle school class size is flat is because our schools made a fundamental decision to change their model. Under a middle school model, very typically in a seven-period day, teachers will teach five classes, have one period for planning, and then they'll have what's called a team time, where they where a group of teachers will collaborate and work together to focus on the needs of their students. That team usually teaches the same group of students throughout the day. And this is the way teachers can intervene with students' needs, make sure they're continuing to make academic progress, coordinate curriculum, coordinate homework, and so forth. That our schools decided to put aside, move away from the middle school model, and now teachers are teaching six classes, and their collaboration is done on a catch-as-catch-can basis. The high school, looking at 35 students, you might say, well, that's not a real big change. But you think about a large comprehensive high school, and then you say, well, there's a certain market for certain classes, such as an advanced course in math or science. When this, and that number has remained fairly constant as our, in our schools. When you have a student class of 20, you have to have a much larger class to hit that average when it was 32. So maybe you have to have classes up in the low 40s to make that average. Now that we've raised that to 35, we've had to increase our class sizes elsewhere to keep those, to make sure we can still continue to offer those courses. Advanced courses and professional technical courses, remediation courses, typically are smaller, and therefore what's happened is our core academics for most of our students in English, science, math, and social studies have continued to climb into the high 30s and low 40s. Throughout this period, you can see some of the programs we've eliminated. Within mostly our high schools and middle schools, we've not eliminated any programs per se in our elementaries. We have reduced coaching staff and increased our pay-to-play by 30% to participate in high school sport. Now it costs $130 per sport. We have not purchased, even though we've adopted our elementary science curriculum, and we've not purchased second language or foreign language books that were due to be purchased this year. We've also, over this time, reduced the amount of material or funds going to our schools for classroom supplies by 40%, and we've also reduced our school year each of the last 3 years, 5 days in 2002-03, 1 day last year, and 5 days again this year. And we've significantly reduced the ability of our support for professional development. We do not have, as some other school districts, have a large ending fund balance. As we've been growing, we've been using the money to keep up with growth, and we do not have that fund balance to buffer some of the reductions we've had to work with. If the budget, if the governor's budget is the adopted budget, these are things that we will look at. Now, I have to emphasize, we've not talked with our school board fully with this. We've not talked with our staff fully with these. So these are the items that, as we follow our past practice, we will look at a lot of different things. Shortened school year is a bargainable issue. We'll look at class size again. However, as Carolyn has said, and in an online survey we're conducting, keeping teachers in the classroom is the number one priority, yet it is also one of the areas where you can gain some of the greatest savings. And the high school advisory team with which I work talks always about the teachers and the breadth of classes that are important to them. You can see some of the other areas we could reduce, from support staff and services to athletics, central administration and support services, more in again in the area of professional development. Classroom supplies and textbooks will probably have a zero textbook budget next year no matter what, and as its cost to work with our special needs students go up, we'll probably not be able to meet that, and some deferred maintenance. So you can see those estimates. Then the bottom section deals with just to maintain our current program. I don't want to deal with the large number. I want to deal with the very bottom number that says $4,450,000. Under the governor's budget, that's what we're estimating we would receive. And then if you go back up above that, our estimated per additional cost, we're estimating we'll receive a 60% increase in our PERS rate, jumping from about 10% to 16%. The reason we're lower than Hillsborough, we've already bonded twice. But you can see that $3.5 million coupled with the next item of adding the 5 days back. Again, that's a bargained item. We bargained it this year, so we cannot assume that we'll be able to bargain that with our association next year. We're at $5.2 million. The money that under the governor's budget is gone before we start. And therefore, you can see some of the other assumptions we made in terms of what a normal year might look like in terms of rolling up to get to that $10,825,000. And while at the same time trying to grow our ending fund balance so that for two purposes, to cushion any future blows and to also, or downturns, and also prepare for the second year of the biennium, and also to maintain our bond rating because we know we'll need to be asking for additional support for construction, and we want to maintain our bond rating as high as possible. So those are the numbers, and that's the Ben Lapine Public Schools, and we'd be willing to entertain any questions. Good morning, Representative Burley.
Thank you. Okay. We have about 6 minutes for questions, and Representative Wisnett.
Well, thanks to both Dr. Platt and Dr. Nelson for coming over. I know Dr. Nelson's, he's called the COLA. Senator Gorley, you
yes.
Be
you were here.
I'd like to really direct my comments to the committee. Look at these numbers. You know, look at the growth. I mean, we have some significant problems, and that's the numbers you got today are almost the same in Redmond. We're growing in Central Oregon. We have some problems. The people have funded the last. They funded a construction, big construction bond. They have turned down the last two bonds for operating money. But I'd like to remind this committee that we have a school formula that was created in 1991 that I think is outdated, and we really need to address this. Our state is changing. We're paying $56 million a year for students that are not in the classroom. And I have a school district here that's growing by 1,200 students a year, and it's going to be it's projected to keep going. So our formula doesn't – they're paying – for those students that are not in the classroom to have those schools that have declining enrollment. I think we really need to look at the school formula to help these communities that are growing tremendously, and it's putting a big burden on the taxpayers and on the system for them to provide quality education.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gorley.
If I may respond to my friend, the good representative. I want you to know that I definitely hear what you're calling for, and you've made that call several times now on this committee. And I want you to know that I absolutely agree with you. It is something that we need to do, and we need to do it in this session.
Thank you,
Senator. Senator Nelson and Senator Walker was first.
Okay.
She's giving me an evil eye, Senator Nelson. Senator Walker, then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The evil eyes over there.
Yeah. Well, I want to comment, follow up on what my colleague said, because we had testimony yesterday from districts with declining enrollment. And today we have testimony with districts that have rapid enrollment. We just heard from Hillsborough, who's the fourth largest district. So there is a problem here. It seems the districts that have flat enrollment are doing a little bit better, but not much. I want to ask you, I'm chair of the Education Committee, and so I've been collecting newspaper articles from around the state that people write and we see about education. And I bet this one did not escape your notice. This was an editorial, in my opinion, by Frank Fiedler.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And so
what the community will support and hasn't supported.
Yeah, I'd like you to comment on that if you would. And I don't mean to bash your community at all. But he raises some real interesting questions about mm-hmm. where your priorities are mm-hmm. in Bend mm-hmm. and Lapine and mm-hmm. the districts you cover. And he, of course, he says some things that get you pretty excited, like in Ben Lapine, the federal No Child Left Behind Act is known as Every Child Left Behind. We probably don't need to go there, but what he does say is that your district has failed to pass a local option levy twice, and I think we just heard from Hillsborough about that same issue.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're rapidly growing districts, mm-hmm. and so I need to understand where you're coming from. And then he talks about how your community is just growing by leaps and bounds and spending significant money on buildings and fire stations, but there's no investment in K through 12. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't necessarily believe that's true, but could you just talk about that a little bit and what your community, if he's representing a sense of your community?
I'll let Senator Devlin, Senator Walker, how about if Carolyn starts and I'll...
Sure, I'm happy to hear.
Okay. I thought it was a very poignant editorial that he wrote, and I see it as an observation and a comment. I'm not sure it is an absolute truth. Our community, I would say, has about 30% of its population involved in the schools. We are a destination retirement community in many ways. We are also growing with small and young families, but there's a dichotomy there. Many of the people are choosing to retire to Central Oregon for the lovely lifestyle and weather, and they have an attitude of been there, done that, supported it already. But when the sheriff comes out and presses a levy at the same time that the schools do and threatens security issues, that speaks to retired folk more than supporting the schools. I think we can do a better job of making economic a tie, an analysis for our community, why investment in education is extremely important. It's our future. There is economic vitality to a good, healthy public school system. And I think we probably need to do a better job of that. But that needs to be made for people. They don't get it. So that would be one of my observations on that. The districts that Frank Fiedler refers to are self-taxing districts. The Parks and Rec, for example, can use, and a number of them, a number of the districts that he mentions are tied to SDCs, which help support growth. So there is a difference in the way in which the school district can raise some money.
I think if I may follow up, the other thing is that, as Carolyn said, we're very rapidly growing, but it's an aging population. Recently, the city of Bend did a survey, and the average age is increasing because more retirees are moving to the community, and I think it becomes more a taxation issue than anything else. The second thing is there's a misunderstanding about how schools are funded, mm-hmm. and we had many comments, well, look at all this growth, all these new houses, aren't you getting more money? And when we tell people, no, under our current school formula, when we contribute more at the local level, the state sends us less money. And I was speaking to the Sun River Rotary, and I asked the question, does that make sense? And they looked at me, and they said no. And I said, well, how can I explain it better? And they said, well, your explanation is good. The system doesn't make sense. And so I think we have to continually, because the changing nature of our community, bringing people from all over the United States and all over the world don't understand how schools are funded. We have to continually educate and re-educate on the same issue. So that's part of it.
And, Mr. Chair, could I follow up just
yes.
briefly? Has the chalkboard project been to your community and helped in that just
twice?
Just last Wednesday we had our regional forum.
Okay. Well, because they came before our committee and talked about their project and how that was, there was a disconnect in the public perception about schools, and I think clearly Mr. Fiedler expresses that.
I agree.
And
I agree.
You're not alone.
We need to work on that.
Well, I didn't mean to highlight.
No, I thought it was an excellent editorial.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and that's why I put it in my book of collected articles, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
One more question, and then I'll ask a final question, but we have to get on to the final school district.
I was just going to ask about the SDs, your opinion of the world.
Well, we knew you'd ask the Senator Nelson. Last spring, I testified regarding ESDs to both House Committee, House Education Committee, and Senate Education Committee. I'm on record as saying all dollars that have go to the ESDs should currently come to the local school districts. Now, I've looked at Senator Ringo's bill. I understand what he's trying to do. And when we look at what we're trying, what we think should be accomplished, first of all, we believe that there needs to be the consolidations that are being proposed. The number we're not particularly concerned with, as long as there's a significant reduction to create the efficiencies that we believe that'll come from larger systems, and to make sure there's equity in funding across the state. We have been the lowest funded ESD for a long time. We're still the lowest funded ESD, and we want to make sure that equity comes into place so that all students are being treated equally through the ESD formula. Now, although I'm on record as saying all the dollars ought to come to the school districts and then we make a decision on how those dollars are to be used by purchasing services from the ESDs, as I told Senator Wisnett yesterday, that's not a hill on which I'm going to die, because I believe that there's many ways to accomplish the same thing. And I know that as we look at how the dollars are utilized, it seems to me that there are other ways to look at the formula. So, for example, instead of directing 5% of the state school support fund to the ESDs, 3% might be directed to the state school support fund, with the districts then receiving those additional 2%. And where the programs that the ESDs offer do make sense, and in our education market, we'll use those dollars to maximize the use of those for the students that we serve, because we need to be looking at the dollars that we can get the most bang for our buck at this point in time, not what services might be offered. We need to take the reverse from what's really going to service our students. That might be a shift that would be equally acceptable to us.
Can I add that Dr. Nelson and one of our school board members sits on the ESD budget committee? So they're intimately involved with the budget.
Last 2 years, the chair of our budget committee has been our assistant superintendent for operations. So it's been moved to basically superintendents with with the board members sprinkled in.
Can I get a very...
Just don't forget about our smaller ESDs in my part of the country. And there are whole different dynamics from what you're talking about.
I understand. And yeah. I came from a system where there were 57 school districts in a very large ESD, and I don't believe anybody, and this was in the state of Washington, I don't believe anybody received any fewer services just because of the size and because of breadth.
Very quick question, just a very quick answer. What's your number of days in terms of your teacher contracts, and how many days are those in the classroom?
Senator Devlin, I'm glad that was asked before so I could quickly make we have a 190-day contract in a typical year. This year we're at 185 days. Of the 185 days, 4 days are for state-mandated holidays, 6 days are for teacher work days, 6 days are for in-service professional development. That takes us down to about 169 student days, and then we have 4 days for parent-teacher conferences, so 165 days this year.
Is instructional days.
Those are instructional days. We've been trying to increase that, but because of the budget, we've been moving backwards.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have to proceed very rapidly. We have one more school district, Silver Falls School
District.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you very much.
Given the fact that there have been so many questions and in fairness to this school district, I would ask committee members if they could please stay till 10:35.
Yes.
If you could state your name for the record.
My name is Craig Rossler. I'm superintendent of Silver Falls School District in Silverton, Oregon, about 10 miles east of here. And I want to thank the chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to address you this morning. A little bit of background about our district. We serve approximately 3,500 students in 13 schools. Our district encompasses about 260 square miles. The major industries include farming, nursery stock, and timber. Many residents are employed outside of the Sword Falls School District. It's becoming much more of a bedroom community. We had rapid enrollment growth in the early and mid-90s, and the district's enrollment since that time has been steadily declining. And I will say that having managed both growth and declining enrollment as a superintendent, I'd much rather manage growth. Growth brings additional money with additional students. Declining enrollment means you lose dollars. However, with the onset of several large housing developments, the enrollment is expected to begin to grow over the next several years. The comparisons that I'm going to share with you this morning, for the most part, are between the 2001-2002 and 2004-2005 school years, with one exception. And this comes right out of audited figures in the data-based education initiative. If you turn to page 2, in the section labeled students, you can see that our enrollment has declined by about 6.5%, a drop of 242 students. But as you notice here, we don't have a proportionate decline in the number of special education students. So while our overall population has dropped, student population, the number of special education students has not dropped as significantly. The same with the ESL population. Again, it has not dropped as significantly. And ESL makes up about 20% of our student population, and that's a significant change in Sword Falls School District since the early 1980s. I was a principal in 1982, became superintendent in 1987, and that's one of the more significant changes in our district. Students in poverty, this is based on the 2000 census, and I think the 2000 census for some reason did a poor job in our area, because I can tell you our students on free and reduced lunch count has gone from 33% up to around 36% during the same period of time. So I think the fact that we have people living in rural areas up roads, gravel roads, etc., I'm just not certain that the census captured all those folks. Minority students has declined, again, not as in the proportion to the overall enrollment. One of the things that I want to point out, if you look at our ESL population, it's around 700 students, and our minority students is only 528. You might ask, how could that be? We have a significant population of Russian students who are not categorized as minority. And those students speak English as a second, or are learning English. Our dropout rate is around the state average. My estimate for this school year is it's going to increase somewhat. Our four-year dropout rate, again, is somewhat under the state average, but we believe it's going to continue to grow. And I'll, in just a few minutes, explain to you why I think that's happening. The next set of figures, I think, are particularly disturbing. If you look at our licensed staff, we had 221 teachers in 2001. We're now down to 190. That's a drop of 31 teachers, or a drop of 14%. And that's a much steeper decline than our overall drop in student enrollment, which is only 6.5%. So what we're seeing in the Silver Falls School District, and I again have the perspective of having been a superintendent there since 1987, is a slow dismantling of a school district. Instructional assistance has gone up somewhat. That's primarily driven as we move dollars that come from the federal government into Title I services and into special education services. School administrators, if you compare or combine those two columns, we've eliminated one administrator. And classified support staff, which would be your custodians, cooks, etc., is down somewhat. Any question on page 2? Okay. On to page 3, general fund expenditures. You can see in direct classroom expenditures, we had an expenditure of $3,659. I want to point out in the next column, I'm using not the 2004-2005 figures, because those are unknown yet. We're in that school year. I'm actually using the audited figures for 2003-2004. And you can see that our direct classroom support has dropped by 1.6%. There has not been any sort of a growth because of inflation. Classroom support is down significantly, and we are at a bare bottom budget when it comes to textbooks, supplies, instructional materials, etc. There really is nothing else to cut in that area. Building support is up somewhat, and part of that was some primarily driven by transportation. We have a high cost for transportation in our district. We stagger the starting times. We have kids that live 10 miles from their school building, and they travel about an hour and a half on the bus because we try to make as efficient a use as we can of those buses, so we have as few buses on the road as possible. But it is a high cost driver in our district. And then central support is down somewhat. If you go to all other operating funds, this includes the general fund plus the federal dollars and other grants that we receive, we've seen some growth, and that primarily is driven by the additional dollars coming from the federal government for NCLB and Title I. Classes, you can see class sizes at the bottom are growing. This is the elementary class size, and I can tell you that the high school class size, while I don't have those figures with me today, the numbers are up significantly at the high school level. We have made a concerted effort to try and put our dollars into the elementary grades, primarily the primary grades, because we believe if we can make a difference with kids in the first 3 to 4 years of school, it will pay off in the long run. If you go on to page 4, this is an indication of some of the specialist positions that we've cut. Of the 31 teachers, you can see that we've cut 4 music teachers. We've cut 2 PE specialists. We've cut our tag teacher for grades K to 8. We've cut 1 administrator. We've cut a media specialist. Alternative education teachers for grades 9 through 12. One of the things that we did in the late 1990s is that we added some alternative programs to try to address our dropout rate. Unfortunately, as our dollars have disappeared, we've had to cut back on those services, and that's one of the reasons I think our dropout rate is going to increase again. In art teachers, we've cut. The remaining teaching positions, the other 19 positions out of the 31, were primarily classroom teachers that were cut in our district. We also closed the smallest elementary school in our district. It recently reopened as a charter school under the sponsorship of the Silver Falls School District and has been very successful so far. We reduced 3 school days during the 2002-2003 school year. Each of our school days is worth about $100,000. We restored that those 3 days the following year. In addition to staff, we severely cut back on our maintenance budget. We now react to problems rather than carrying out planned maintenance designed to prevent problems. We have curtailed the purchase of textbooks, instructional materials, computer hardware, and software, and significantly reduced our financial investment in staff training. My prediction for the governor's budget, if it were funded at the $5.0 billion figure, is that we will reduce an additional 5 classroom teachers and 6 full-time educational assistants. We will again stagnate on the purchase of textbooks, instructional equipment. In addition, any sort of planned maintenance will not be addressed. Middle school sports will be further reduced, and funds for staff training will remain inadequate. I estimate that a state school support fund budget of $5.3 million would allow the Silver Falls School District to kind of maintain the status quo and to purchase some textbooks for our students. But my estimate is complicated by the fact that our district will begin collective bargaining with the Classified Association this afternoon and with our teachers later this year. So we have 2 contracts that we're going to be negotiating, so we don't know what our cost drivers will be when it comes to health insurance and salaries and wages. That was a quick overview, I hope efficient, and I'm now ready to answer any questions you might have.
We'll start off with the basic questions so we get those out of the way. Your number, your contract days,
yes,
and the number of actual instructional days.
Right. We have 192 contract days with our teachers. which is a little bit higher than the state average, I believe. We have 176 full instructional days with our high school students and 172 full instructional days with our elementary students. And I emphasize full because I think you need to make certain when you're comparing those figures whether you have half days for parent conferences and those sorts of things. And ours are full instructional days.
And in terms of the state report card and annual yearly progress, where's the school district?
Our high school did not meet adequately yearly progress in two areas. One of them was special education. The other was with our English as a second language students. Therefore, the district did not meet AYP. When it comes to the state report card, we had one of our elementary schools that was rated exceptional. We had four of them were rated strong. And our other schools were all rated satisfactory.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Would you please provide for the committee in a written form your strategic plan for dealing with the ESL and the special ed students?
I'd be happy to do that.
All right. May I ask another question?
Yes, Senator.
Different subject. I'm curious, what happens with high school students, your graduates, in the Silver Falls School District? Do they stay in the community? Do they leave, go elsewhere? Trends?
I would say trends. There aren't a lot of job opportunities in the Silver Falls School District. Now, there are in the communities that surround us, and we have lots of people who commute to the Portland area and to the Salem area. It is a, I think, a family-friendly community, so lots of the people that move there are moving there because it seems like a friendly community and a good place to raise kids or to retire. And we do find over time that it seems to attract students back that have left us, that have gone on to four-year colleges. Some tend to gravitate back to Silver Falls School District because they also want to raise their family in a kind of a small community, small town. But many have to leave for job opportunities.
Additional questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
You seem to ask about the ESD issue. Your view of the world, ESD?
Well, I think I can't give you the number of ESDs that we should have, but I believe that we probably have too many ESDs and there needs to be some consolidation. I believe if we didn't have ESDs for middle-sized school districts like the Silver Falls School District or for small districts, that we'd reinvent ESDs. I mean, we would have to consort with our neighboring districts to provide services in an efficient and effective manner. So I think ESDs play an important role. For me, the issue is more around funding of ESDs and the governance of ESDs. The governance of ESDs, it seems to me that K-12 districts are the number one and primary customers of ESDs. And so I would like to see ESDs governed by board members that represent the K-12 districts that are served by the ESDs, rather than a separate elected board. I think they would be more responsive and understanding about the needs of our K-12 districts. I also like what's happened in one or more of the ESDs where the budget committee is made up of superintendents of K-12 districts that are served by the ESD. It seems to me it just brings a higher level of accountability to the ESDs. When it comes to funding of ESDs, it also seems to me that we have kind of an interesting dynamic occurring, is that we send 5% of the state school fund to ESDs. They also set the prices. Now, we get to decide within our Willamette ESD the menu of services, but they decide how much those services are going to cost. So they get the money, and they set the price. It seems to me to be kind of an odd arrangement. And I would suggest that you may want to look at sending additional dollars from that 5% to the K-12 districts and then letting them decide whether they want to buy services back from their ESD or whether they want to consort with their local districts. I recognize for small districts in particular that idea is somewhat frightening, because they're afraid, I think, if they end up with the dollars in their hands, they don't have the bargaining power and the economy of scale that you might find with medium-sized and larger districts. So I think you need to be careful about that. I would not suggest you send all the dollars back to K-12 districts. And maybe you would allow within a district region some sort of sliding scale where you now have a 95% of the dollars go to K-12 districts and 5% to ESDs. You might want to have a sliding scale where 98% of the dollars a maximum can come to K-12 districts and 2% to the ESD. But within that ESD region, they could decide to change that scale and go down to the minimum where 5% goes to the ESD and 95% to the district. So you would have some sort of local control recognizing the uniqueness of certain ESDs in the state. But it seems to me that the issue is around governance and the funding of ESD. And I would like to hope the Oregon legislature in 2005 can address those two issues.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gorley was first, then okay. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Within that ESD menu, as you mm-hmm. as you put it, what on the menu is most critical?
Special education for us. I mean, in the Willamette ESD for many years was primarily a special education shop. After special education, I would say it's curriculum and assessment. Medium-sized and small districts simply don't have the central office staff to analyze and crunch the numbers and to do the sort of curriculum development that we need to do. And plus, I don't think we want to duplicate that amongst medium-sized and small districts. And so we rely on our ESD for significant support and expertise in the area of curriculum and assessment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gordley, then Representative Jensen. Senator Walker, then Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Mr. Rosso for coming again. He came in front of our Education Committee, and I shared your opinions in Roseburg, and there were some differing opinions from that. But I really appreciate the perspective about this ESD consolidation issue that you bring to the table. And I haven't actually talked to you about this yet, but I appointed a work group yesterday, and I'm still in the process of putting that work group together. And I'd very much like you to be a part of that. And you can refuse because you don't have enough time. But you were the only one who talked about the governance and the funding issue, and I thought that was really added a very important element to the discussion.
I'd be happy to serve. And
thank you.
Yes.
And did you visit my old school?
Yes, I did visit. Senator Walker went in 7th and 8th grade to one of our schools as a former Butte Creek Bobcat, so she shared that with me. Yeah.
Butte Creek Elementary School. So right. I was brave enough to give him my maiden name so he'd be able to find out all those bad things
right.
in my disciplinary file, which hopefully is all gone by now.
Well, certainly it is. Yeah, I can tell you the students there are following you now.
Great.
I think it adds some concreteness to the work of governance when you can read about people that have some connection to your lives. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. Mr. Ross, if you would tell them, I'd be happy to come out to Butte Creek Elementary School, bring my old yearbook, show them what I looked like in the 8th grade, and talk to them about state government.
I'm certain they'd like to have you out there.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
I'm not sure where the previous questioning was or comments were going. But let me get back on track as far as the Silver Falls School District is concerned. I note that you expressed some concern about the possibility of increased dropout rates in your district. And I know it's a complex formula as to why sometimes students drop out, why they do not drop out. But one of the things that seems in my limited exposure to education to keep students in schools is some of the extracurricular types of activities. We frequently look at sports programs as illustrations and examples of this. Infrequently, I think we look at things, we fail we frequently fail, if that's stated correctly, to look at some of the other extra things, curricular type of things that may keep students in school. And it's not just with your school that this comment is being addressed, but I see you've dropped four music teachers. And my suspicion, and I don't know your schools, but my suspicion is that the performance aspect of music in your school has declined as a complement of this reduction. And I fear, Mr. Chair, this is something we sometimes don't, you know, one of the areas we sometimes don't talk about. I fear that this has an adverse effect on, in essence, what one of the missions of our schools are, and that is keeping students in school, getting them through the process, and graduating. And I don't know that I'm looking for a response as much as I'm making an editorial comment from my observation.
I would say your fear is a real fear. It's a legitimate fear. And yes, the performance quality, despite the efforts of the kids and the instructors, has dropped.
Volunteers and various others, right. But yes.
Any additional questions? Well, thank you very
much.
Superintendent Rossler. I just passed a note to the Education Substantive Committee Chair saying to please get you on the ESD work group, because you have some of the clearest statements about ESDs that we've heard so far on this committee in terms of having sort of clear opinions, and at least you gave the clearest explanation of what the primary roles are of ESDs that I've heard, and I've talked to a lot of ESDs lately.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and your comments.
Thank you.
Bye.
So that the committee knows where we're going now, and just again to thank the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association for arranging these 2 days, we were trying to give sort of a micro view of what the impact of the governor's budget is on school districts. Tomorrow, we are going on to community colleges and workforce development, but rather than have the committee like change gears, I hope you don't actually change gears. I'd like you to keep in mind the testimony that you've heard over the last 2.5 weeks from the Department of Education and on the State School Fund, and hopefully we can try to look at this more as a continuum to see basically what sort of a public education system we have in this state. And so I'm hoping that we can continue this discussion and basically make all the connections that I think are important for us to connect. If there is there anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment, the board chair, Cordry, mentioned that she was somewhat chagrined, in my words, to be presiding over a decline in education. And many of us, I know, who got elected trying to improve the education system. And here we are after a couple of voter turnarounds and dealing with the aftermath of Measure 5 and other issues of not being able to improve education as we would like to see education improved. And so we certainly share your feelings in that. So thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned till tomorrow morning at 8:30.